The Judicial District has been working in anticipation of the possibility of a suspension.
A Bethel judge is ordered off the bench by the Alaska Supreme Court. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, the 17th of July. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, scientists work to better understand ocean currents.
It said that the drifters were going to go clockwise through Prince William Sound, and all the drifters went counterclockwise through Prince William Sound.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
The Alaska Supreme Court has ordered a Bethel District judge to be suspended. It's the first time that a judge has been suspended in Alaska's history. In a decision yesterday, the court ordered Dennis Cummings to be suspended from the bench for 3 months. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning Barnes reports.
The suspension comes after a year of investigation into allegations of misconduct while Cummings was presiding in Bethel. Cummings has been a district court judge in Bethel for over 3 years. In a trial in March of 2008, Cummings passed a note to an Alaska state trooper who was a witness in the case and the judge's friend. Cummings told the trooper, quote, "just in case you want to go fishing." But the note contained evidence about the trial. And the next day in court, Cummings passed a second note addressed to the trooper and the prosecutor, which also contained trial evidence. The Alaska Commission on Judicial Conduct looked into these allegations and found them to be true. They recommended in November that Cummings be suspended because he violated Alaska's Code of Judicial Ethics. This week, the Alaska Supreme Court agreed with the Commission's many findings, including that passing the note was ex parte communication and that the fishing comment created an appearance of impropriety. In its decision, the court found, quote, "these were significant violations of ethical duty owed the legal system, and that they affected the ability of the system to fulfill its obligation to resolve disputes impartially and maintain the public trust," end quote. How long to make the suspension was still in question, because the Alaska court has never suspended a judge before. The American Bar Association's baseline suspension for a lawyer's misconduct is at least 6 months. The court applied that baseline to Cummings' suspension, but reduced it by 3 months because of mitigating factors. Those factors included that Cummings had no prior discipline record, there was no dishonest or selfish motive, and he was remorseful and recognized his conduct was wrong. The court found only one aggravating factor, which was that Cummings had, once before, passed a note during a previous trial. No action was taken at that time. Cummings' 3-month suspension is set to begin July 27th and will be without pay. The court ordered that Cummings get ethics training that will be supervised by the Conduct Commission before returning to the bench October 27th.
The Judicial District has been working in anticipation of the possibility of a suspension.
Ron Woods is the area court administrator for the 4th Judicial District based in Fairbanks. He says they have plans for covering for Cummings while he's gone. He says they have a tentative agreement for bringing in retired Alaskan judge Ethan Windall for most of the 3 months.
The Bethel court, of course, is a very, very busy court, very busy region, and it's very important to the court and certainly the judicial district here to maintain the level of service and timeliness that we strive to maintain.
Cummings was up for retention during the general election in November. He received enough votes to be retained for the next 4 years. Cummings is out of town until next week and could not be reached for comment. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
Alaska's lone U.S. House member is continuing to rack up hefty legal bills. Congressman Don Young is also still paying them out of money donated to his campaign fund. The 19-term representative filed disclosure forms this week with the Federal Election Commission. They show he spent more than $37,000 in the last quarter on lawyers. The money went to 3 different firms, but Young does not have to disclose what the payments are for. The biggest expense is to the Washington, D.C. law firm of Tobin O'Connor and Ewing. Brewing. Young paid it $22,000 and still owes the firm an additional $46,000. Additional payments went to another D.C. law firm and one in Seattle. Young has been the target of federal investigation but has not been charged with any wrongdoing. However, the legal probes have had other repercussions. Young stepped down from his powerful leadership spot on the House Natural Resources Committee last year because of pressure from fellow Republicans. He's been investigated as part of the ongoing federal probe into corruption in Alaska politics surrounding oil field services company VECO. The Senate also took the unusual step last year of calling for an investigation into how Young's staff inserted a $10 million earmark for a Florida highway interchange project into a federal highway bill after the House and Senate voted on it. In the past 2.5 years, Young has spent more than $1.1 million from his campaign fund on legal bills. He started a legal expense fund last year after fielding criticism for spending his war chest on lawyers. He spent more than $73,000 from that fund. Young announced last month that he will seek re-election in 2010. It's far earlier than he usually declares his candidacy. So far, no one has announced they plan to contest him. A deadline is approaching for some people seeking disaster unemployment assistance from this spring's flooding. The deadline for applying for the FEMA-funded program is July 23rd for 12 communities, including Eagle, Circle, Stevens Village, Fort Yukon, and Tanana, and several others on the Yukon and Kuskokwim Rivers. Program coordinator Nancy Davis says disaster unemployment assistance is for people like the self-employed or operators of home-based businesses who aren't eligible for regular unemployment coverage.
So if the disaster makes it impossible for them to work, to continue their own business, then they would be eligible for disaster unemployment assistance.
Davis says that includes those who mine or fish for a living and lost property that affects their ability to work.
If people had damages to their equipment or to their home, if it was a home-based business that makes it impossible for them to work, then they could be eligible for disaster unemployment assistance.
Davis says employees that don't qualify for regular unemployment insurance because they lack earnings history for the previous year can also be eligible. Weekly benefits range from $102 to $370 a week, depending on income history. Additional benefits are available for those with dependents. While the application deadline for residents of most flood-affected communities is next week, a later deadline of August 8th has been set for those who live in downriver villages that experienced flooding later and were subsequently added to the federal disaster declaration. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, warm weather may hang around longer than expected.
During the summer, if we're in an El Nino, then that has a tendency to produce these strong wildfire seasons.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment. On the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Lightning-caused forest fire has added more work to the state's fire suppression efforts. The Katsina fire in the Copper Basin consumed only about a tenth of an acre when it was doused by water from water-scooping planes. It is being staffed by 3 personnel and is considered fully contained. The Upper Healy River fire is about 60% contained, according to Tom Kurth with the state's fire operations.
Right now we have 4 crews on that fire, and they have been able to continue that work there and keep that fire contained, and they should have that fire wrapped up in a couple of days. All the values at risk there have been protected.
More than 60 personnel are working on the 61-acre fire. The Shanta Creek fire on the Kenai Peninsula continues to draw the bulk of fire suppression personnel. More than 400 people are working on that fire. Crews are looking for hot spots and checking the northern and eastern perimeters of the fire, which started on June 30th. The Shanta Creek fire has burned more than 13,000 acres. Scientists are launching a barrage of measuring instruments into Prince William Sound over the next 2 weeks in hopes of improving their ability to predict weather, ocean currents, and fishery prospects. APRN's Steve Heimel tells us more about the Sound Predictions Project.
A drifter is a small floating transmitter tethered to a device similar to a parachute that pulls it with the current. Field team leader Scott Pigao of the Oil Spill Recovery Institute in Cordova says when drifters were launched and tracked 5 years ago, a computer model generated by the National Aeronautics and Space Administration's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California failed to predict where the drifters would drift.
The model that was used in 2004, the first version that was being tested, it said that the drifters were going to go clockwise through Prince William Sound, and all the drifters went counterclockwise through Prince William Sound.
The sound predictions effort will generate a flood of new data about the current salinity and content of the water in the central part of Prince William Sound. It will involve shore-based radar, 3 boats, 2 launches of drifters, a balloon, and 2 underwater vehicles. The equipment will also go on display in Valdez on the 28th, and the data can be seen on a website as it comes in and compared to the computer model. The Alaska Ocean Observing System is a consortium of agencies aiming to develop a predictive capability similar to weather forecasts. The payoffs will be a better ability to respond to emergencies such as oil spills. One of their devices is an infrared sensor on a tethered balloon that can hang in the air 500 feet over a spill to track the oil day or night. The 2 submersibles they're using can sample the water all the way to the bottom of the ocean. One, the Remus, is similar to a torpedo, and the other, the glider, looks like an airplane. Pigao says they will surface from time to time to transmit their data and get their positions and instructions.
The glider and the Remus both need to come to the surface because they need navigation information. They need to get hold of the GPS. They also phone home. So they'll call in and say, hey, do you want me to do something different? The glider is actually calling New Jersey. The Remus calls California, which then bounces back up to Prince William Sound. And it just gives us a chance to control them along with them being able to find their navigation.
One of the points of fielding so much technology at once is to see what works and what's most economical for future monitoring efforts. The oceanographic information will also have some applications in biology for fisheries scientists. Pigao says there will be some biological monitoring as well as part of the project.
We have bird and mammal observers, and we'll be making oceanographic conditions. And so we'll be looking at that. We'll be looking at other circulation issues above and beyond what the models can provide.
The website to track the sound predictions effort is www.aoos.org. Along with the data displays, there's a blogger on one of the vessels who's been keeping a log since they began installing the radar. Ashore in Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
A week-long tour of aviation facilities in and around Anchorage wraps up today for 15 students from the Lower Kuskokwim School District. The group is taking part in the UAA-sponsored Aviation Careers Camp. Rocky Capozzi is the director of UAA's Aviation Technology Program. He says this year's group of students were selected by the school district's superintendent, John Lamont, who is an alumni of UAA and wanted some of his students to learn about aviation careers.
My hat's off to John as the district superintendent for following through and basically providing the financial resources to get transportation for the kids down here and to be able to afford the they stayed in the dorm rooms on the university, and there was a fee for that. And John was able to get the money, and what he did, he actually did the selection process within the district, and so I think there was some sort of a competitive process.
Is it specifically geared toward Native students?
I don't know that it was specifically geared to Natives, but that's certainly the way it has unfolded. You know, from our perspective, we wanted to get students in from remote Alaska. I'm not telling you anything to say it's just as expensive to go visit a village on the west coast of Alaska as it is to fly to Seattle, for instance. So in terms of recruiting, it's very difficult. I mean, it's, you know, we don't have the money to do that, and this is so much better than a recruiting trip because they get to actually experience, so many things that are inspiring and things they haven't seen before.
Rocky Capozzi is the director of UAA's Aviation Technology Program. Students finished the week at Elmendorf Air Force Base this afternoon checking out C-17s and F-22s. APRN's Susanna Caldwell caught up with the students yesterday. She reports that the group learned there's more to aviation careers than just being a bush pilot.
On his 18th birthday, Gregory Stronghart found out that careers in aviation go far beyond the things he's seen growing up in the Western Alaska village of Nunum Iqua. For example, on his birthday, he got arrested. Visiting the Ted Stevens International Airport Fire and Rescue Center Thursday morning, the police even cuffed him up and put him in the back of a police cruiser. His gag arrest was part of one of the many aviation facility tours he and his fellow campers went on to explore possible careers in the aviation industry. For 1 week, they visited different places around Anchorage that do work in the industry, including Linden Air Cargo, Merrill Field's Control Tower, Lake Hood, and the Aviation Heritage Museum. Stronghart says that he's wanted to be a pilot for years, but that the trip has given him a better idea of what he needs to do to achieve his goals.
Well, first I'd like to get my private pilot's license. Then I'd like to get a commercial pilot license to fly people around and cargo. Then after that, I'd want to get, to fly one of those really big planes around the world. That's my goal for now.
It's all stuff he's learned at the camp.
It shows me the opportunities, what I could become a pilot and what I could be doing in the future. Like where I could be flying. People showed me places of Japan, Europe, and some other cool places. It's really made it pretty interesting for me. Makes me want to go out and explore too, like the world.
James Joe, 14 and from Hooper Bay, thought the most fun came in the form of a full-motion flight simulator.
Like you go in a full-body cockpit, like up there, but then instead of screens, you're five screens on each side, left. And when you turn back left, you'll feel like you're going left. Like it does a, you have to measure how fast it takes because of the air density.
He talks about the difference of air density between Anchorage and Denver and how it affects how a plane stays in the air. Then he talks about radar simulators and air traffic control simulators, heavy stuff for the students, all between the ages of 11 and 18. But for Joe, his inspiration is simple.
Seeing birds flying over me inspires me to become a pilot.
Along with the aviation tours, the students have also been doing regular city things, swimming at Goose Lake, riding the bus, shopping at the popular Fifth Avenue Mall, and just being typical teenagers. The students will also visit Elmendorf Air Force Base to view the fighter planes and a control tower before returning to their homes in western Alaska. In Anchorage, I'm Susanna Caldwell.
An ocean temperature-driven trend that affects the weather is showing signs of warming. Southern Pacific water temperatures appear headed into an El Niño, or warm phase. Martha Schulsky, climatologist at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, says the short-term phenomenon has been in a neutral stage for about a year following a nine-month cooling or La Niña episode. Schulsky says a switch back to El Niño means warming for Alaska.
When we're in a pattern of El Niño, what that means is an increase in southerly flow along with the repositioning of the Aleutian Low where it strengthens and moves a bit eastward. And so that's what causes the warmer than normal temperatures. And usually for wintertime, if we have warmer than normal weather, we generally have wetter than normal conditions.
Schulsky says the Alaska Climate Center predicts warmer than normal conditions in Alaska for the next 3 months. The precipitation outlook is inconclusive except for western Alaska, where more rain is forecast. Schulsky says the return of El Niño and this summer's hot temperatures and large wildfires fall in line with data from past record fire years.
Both summers, 2004 and 2005, were El Niño and weak El Niño patterns. And if you look back at, say, 1957, that was another high wildfire season, and that was also an El Niño pattern. So just given those three cases, it seems that during the summer, if we're in an El Niño, then that has a tendency to produce these strong wildfire seasons.
Shulsky says it's believed that global warming increases the intensity of shorter-term patterns like El Niño or La Niña. Indications are mixed from a longer-running ocean temperature-driven trend called the Pacific Decadal Oscillation. The PDO is a 20 to 30-year-long warming or cooling pattern in the North Pacific that's also tied to weather and environmental effects. Shulsky says it's thought to be headed into a cold phase, but that it's hard to predict how the opposing forces of the PDO and El Niño will interplay.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Communication Systems, converging voice, video, internet, and data applications for business. ACS connects companies from the North Slope to Ketchikan to each other and the rest of the world. And by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
The Fairbanks Borough is seeking voter signatures statewide for an initiative petition to change state rules that govern local property tax exemptions. The proposal would allow communities to increase the residential property tax exemption from the current $20,000 limit to $50,000. Local real estate agent and former borough assembly member Eileen Cummings, who's been hired to manage the campaign, says the initiative reflects Fairbanks' desire to provide tax relief to homeowners.
We have a lot of people concerned about the rate of property taxes in our community, and that's been a historical issue. And so our mayor just said, let's do something about it. And the assembly agreed because people do complain about property taxes, and so we're hoping this will help.
The exemption would only apply to taxes on owner-occupied homes. Borough Chief Financial Officer Michael Lamb says if implemented, there would also be an increase in the mill rate.
If you increase the exemption, what ends up happening is the net taxable assessed value shrinks, and therefore the mill rate has to incrementally get slightly larger. But the net result for a residential property is that actual taxes themselves are slightly lesser.
Lamb says there are a couple of exceptions under this scenario. Homeowners whose houses are valued in excess of $500,000, people that own properties beyond their primary residence, and commercial property owners would see their tax bills go up. Lamb says that would affect big commercial properties the most.
The pipeline would end up paying more taxes, the refinery, Fort Knox, the big box stores.
Lamb says Alaska communities will have different views on increasing the residential tax exemption depending on their local mix of property types and revenue sources. Cummings says the initiative has obvious appeal in Fairbanks, where alternative taxes have repeatedly failed to gain support and there's been major commercial construction in recent years. But she expects just having the option of increasing the homeowner property tax exemption will have statewide appeal. If the initiative gets enough signatures, it can either be approved directly by the legislature or put to a statewide vote. If approved, it would then be up to communities to decide whether or not to locally employ it. The Craig Ranger District on Prince of Wales Island is putting the final touches on a small but very aggressive stream restoration project. KRBD's Jay Marble went to Snipe Creek and has this story.
To get to the Snipe Creek Restoration Project, you have to go down the Trocadero Trail just off the Heidelberg Road to a point that you're crossing old footbridges that are tumbling into the small streams. When you get to Snipe Creek, you turn upstream and walk through what really seems to be a picturesque landscape. But on this day, when you round a bend, what you hear and then see is a huge backhoe pivoting back and forth, moving whole logs and root wads from one side of the creek to the other, sometimes burying them into the banks. What's happening here is extreme stream restoration. A few days ago, about 150 logs were brought to this stretch of water by helicopter, usually one at a time. Even though this is the middle of the Tongass, there were not any big trees nearby to work with, so they had to be imported from another part of the forest.
We had stockpiled these logs strategically so that the machine can grab them easily.
Brad Barr is a hydrologic technician with the Craig Ranger District.
And in fact, we use the helicopter to place logs using the helicopter specifically to put them in places where we'd leave them and not even touch them with the machine. And then we had the machine, and we were able to grab the logs and configure them into big log jams.
Easy, once you have the big backhoe actually in the creek, getting it here involved using an old access road, then taking it down the bank. And sometimes as much as 40 feet of a tree is up on the floodplain, with other logs stacked on top of it to hold everything in place. Still, there might be another 10 feet or so of the first log sticking out into the water. Sometimes a hole is dug into the bank and the log is buried with just an end sticking out. It's a kind of tough love restoration for an area that was logged intensively in the 60s. It's relatively flat here and close to the estuary, so when it was harvested, pretty much everything was taken. That's why logs from another area had to be brought in. It's not the first time that Snipe Creek has undergone restoration. Occasionally, you find small logs that were placed in the stream with their ends nailed into the bank using pieces of steel rebar. Not a bad effort, but the crews who did this restoration likely used materials that were close at hand. In this case, a small log resulted in a small improvement.
And this structure has been here for quite a long time, and essentially it is functioning. However, it's not doing very much. It's created a minor scour pool on the downstream side, and although it's still here, it's not really functioning to an extent that is very beneficial for the fish.
In short, what Barr wants to end up with is a stream bed that is not so straight, narrow, and uniform. The logs will dam up water in some instances. In other cases, will force the fast-moving winter flows to wash out the soil behind a big root wad, making a deep hole for young salmon.
And we call that off-channel habitat. And so in many stream channels, off-channel habitat's a limiting factor. And so we're always looking for opportunities to create back scour areas or enhance back channels.
The Forest Service is working on about 4,000 feet of Snipe Creek. It's a pretty quick process. The equipment should be removed by the end of July, and Barr says dramatic change in the stream channel should be visible in about 5 years. I'm Jay Marble.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. Weird reports tonight from Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, Jay Marble on Prince of Wales Island, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Steve Heimel, Ellen Lockyer, and Susanna Caldwell from Anchorage. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron, and I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the Doyon family of companies working together to build Alaska's future. Guess who teens say is their most important influence when it comes to sex? Their parents. Listen up. Teens want to know what you think, even if they don't act like it. Talk with your teens about sex, love, and values. Nationwide, one out of every three girls gets pregnant at least once by age 20. Make sure your daughter isn't one of them. Visit stayteen.org for special parent tips and more information on how you can prevent teen pregnancy. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. Providing statewide news coverage since 1978, we are the Alaska Public Radio Network, APRN, your source for Alaska's news.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.